From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to this additional episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, the GPO and GCNCS. Most people now know of the work carried out by Tommy Flowers and his team that led to the design and construction of Colossus, the world's first large-scale electronic digital computer. Flowers worked for the General Post Office at their research station at Dollis Hill, but that work was just one part of the connection between the GPO and the Codebreakers at Bletchley Park during World War II. With the opening this year of our new exhibition, D-Day, Interception Intelligence Invasion, that link with the modern GPO, British Telecom, now BT, continues. In this episode, our research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, sat down with the head of Heritage and Archives for BT, David Hay, to talk about our shared history. Also, in this episode, we bring you something very special indeed. In 1981, at the modern equivalent of Dollis Hill, at Astral Park, Tommy Flowers and some of his original team gave a talk about their wartime work. And thanks to BT, we can bring you highlights of that reunion.
We've talked previously on this podcast about the new D-Day exhibition we have here at Bletchley, which is very generously supported by BT. So, David, what's the connection between BT and Bletchley Park?
Well, the connection between BT and Bletchley Park is a long one. For many people in BT, the main connection used to be the fact that this whole site, Bletchley Park, was owned by BT and was a regional training college from 1948 until about 1991, I think. And indeed, I've worked here occasionally myself in my BT career. So thousands of GPO and BT people have been through here, done their training here, most of them having little or no idea of the significance of the site.
I was going to say, we've had veterans come in saying they trained here as BT engineers and they knew nothing at the time. They were sleeping in bedrooms in Hut 8 and had no idea that it was of any significance at all.
Well, of course, the whole story about the place only came out relatively recently, I think from the late 70s, early 80s, and it took a while for the story to become as widely known as it is today. And I'm sure we're going to hear more and more about it and more with what went on here as more and more is revealed.
Before we've restored a number of the buildings here, we've come across a lot of signs of the BT presence up until relatively recently, as you say, into the 80s, early 90s. But even before the BT presence, the connection goes back longer than that, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, very much so. And it's one of the proudest episodes in BT's long history. BT's history goes back through the days of the GPO, which many people realise. BT was privatised in 84. But our history goes back to the early 19th century because the post office itself took over a number of private telegraph and telephone companies, going back to our earliest ancestor in 1846 and the Electric Telegraph Company. But during the GPO period, during wartime, the GPO did a huge amount to help the war effort. The GPO, as part of government, and being a monopoly supplier of communications, its research establishment was a national, indeed international, centre of scientific and technological expertise. And it was natural that the people at Bletchley Park would approach Dollis Hill, the research establishment at the time during the Second World War, for assistance in helping to develop technology to decipher some of these encrypted messages. And so this is where Tommy Flowers enters the story. An amazing character. A British telecommunications engineer, worked his way up from the bottom as an apprentice with the Royal Woolwich, I think, and then joined the post office as a normal telephone engineer in 1926, transferred to Dollis Hill in 1930, where his skill and expertise were recognised, and he very quickly worked his way up to a senior research position. So by the time of the war, he'd been experimenting in early electronic telephone switching, switching telephones, conversations through telephone exchanges using early electronic equipment. And so he had a great deal of expertise in thermionic valves, early semiconductors, effectively what the Americans call vacuum tubes. And he'd been playing with these in electronic switching and developing large pieces of kit using hundreds and thousands of these thermionic valves. So when he was approached by Bletchley to assist with the Robinson machine, and he very quickly realised that they would never be able to develop that machine that'd be quick enough to fully decrypt at sufficient speed the Lorenz ciphers. So he came up with the idea of developing a device which used large numbers of thermionic valves. And in so doing, really, he was ushering in the digital age, the age of modern computing. But at that stage, he explained his concept and really was largely dismissed by the highly educated boffins at Bletchley Park. And for a while, they preferred to go with the route they had been following already, which is to use mechanical devices, really using relays, mechanical relays. So Tommy went back to Dollis Hill and with his team, he built this machine, which quickly became known as Colossus because it was so huge, and invited the people from Bletchley Park to come and see it for a proof of concept. And the rest is history, really. They were amazed. Colossus was dismantled in late 1943, moved to Bletchley Park, reassembled, and attacked the first codes in anger in February, I think, 1944, in time for D-Day. Hugely increased the number of Lorenz coded messages that were being broken. And, as you know, gave the Allies confidence that D-Day could go ahead in good time, that the enemy were convinced that the D-Day landings would actually take place around Calais.
To go back to some of the process of that, you may be able to shed a little bit of light on it. My understanding is that the Robinson machines, the key finding concept they were using, was the one that had been developed by Tutt and Tiltman previously, but they were doing it essentially with tape and on a sort of electromechanical basis, as you said. Mm. And then Flowers' initial concept is to do the whole thing with valves, but Colossus ends up being a slight compromise in that half the job is done with valves and half the job is still done with tape. So he wasn't able to fulfill his vision completely from that point of view.
No, he wanted to eradicate the tapes altogether. As you say, the problems with the Robinson device is that it chewed the tapes up and the tapes stretched, so the two tapes lost the synchronization, so the errors were creeping in. And as you say, Tommy's original concept was to do away with the tape altogether and to hard code part of it into actually the machine itself. So it would have become actually programmable at that point. But as you say, it was a compromise where they just ran the one tape. But even so, it was a huge advance on Robinson. It was five times as quick, I think, as the Robinson machine. So hugely increased the output of the code breakers.
Yeah, I mean, after D-Day in July, when the Germans go over to changing their settings on the Lorenz machine daily rather than monthly, they find additional uses for Colossus that they didn't realise it could do initially. But once they have the machine, Jack Good and Donald Mickey look at it and they go, oh, wait, it can probably do this as well. So there's a kind of reciprocity between Flowers and his team creating these things and then people coming up with other uses for them. They built something like 10 in the end, didn't they?
So, yeah, the Mark 1 was delivered in January 1944, working in early February 1944. But the Mark 2, which had around 1,000 more valves in it, to 2,400 valves, first one of those arrived just before D-Day. And then subsequently, there were up to 10 Mark 2 Colossuses working here.
There's that wonderful piece in Flowers' diary, isn't it, when he gets it to work in February with, what is it, Colossus did first job, car broke down on way home.
Yeah, so Tommy Flowers has kept a small pocket diary, completely breaking the Official Secrets Act by doing that. It's still owned by the Flowers family. His son, Kenneth Flowers, loaned it to us, and it's shortly going to be on display at the Science Museum on code breaking and DCHQ. And yes, it's a real treasure trove of little snippets into Tommy's activities. And as you say, just very concisely says, Colossus did its first job, car broke down on way home. And I guess that's typical of Tommy in many ways. He was a man of humble origins, very plain spoken, very determined, very focused.
There is a tradition, I think, which people don't appreciate, that Flowers, like many engineers in that period, he gets to where he does through apprenticeship and through doing the job practically. Doc Keane, who worked on the bomb, is another one. Going to university and doing a degree in engineering wasn't really the way things were done during the 30s. At Bletchley, you have your Oxbridge types, your academics, your mathematicians and things, but to turn their great thoughts into practical devices, you need engineers. And engineers in those days have a completely different kind of career path and often come from, you know, different branches of society almost in that way.
Very much so.
Because Flowers did a degree, didn't he? He did a degree
He did it, yeah, in his own time. He was supported by the GPO doing it, but yeah, he did it in his own time in London. And the same was said for his team, because it wasn't just Tommy, he was the leader of that team, but there was a whole group of them, all great men in their own way, who were all apprentices with the GPO, spent their entire careers with the GPO, pre and post-war. And as you say, that was the career path for nuts and bolts engineers in those days. Is it noticeable actually with the TRE, the Telecommunications Research Establishment at Malvern? A lot of those are Oxbridge as well. And academic Jeff Hughes sadly passed away this year from Manchester University. He did some research which showed an awful, surprising number of the people at the TRE when they're at Cambridge or at the Cambridge University Wireless Society. The similar sort of background to the people here, really, at Bletchley Park. But I think the real bridge between Flowers and his team and the rest of the Bletchley Park people was Turing himself, really, because for well-known reasons, he was an outsider himself, although a brilliant man and from an Oxbridge background. Wasn't quite the same kind of set, I suppose, as the rest
Turing
of them here.
Definitely had an interest in sort of practical mechanics. He walked around with gear wheels and boxes of files in his bag because he was building a sort of Babbage-style device out of brass dials. So he had an interest beyond the theoretical in that sense.
I think he had a respect for Flowers, and Flowers certainly respected him, obviously. So I think he was really quite a real bridge here, because there were characters here, of course, who perhaps weren't so sympathetic.
One of the things from the archive is that if you look at the relationship between Dollis Hill and Bletchley Park, both through the development of the four-rotor bomb machine, two versions were built to tackle when four-rotor Enigma machines were introduced for U-boats. You have a Dollis Hill project to build a four-rotor bomb, and then you have Colossus. And the story of both, to a certain extent, is told in long memos from Gordon Welshman. And it's clear from those that Gordon Welshman wasn't Dollis Hill's biggest fan, but he's the person that wrote the most about it. So we have to be a bit careful with that material, that we don't take it all necessarily at face value. There's an incident where Dollis Hill borrows a bomb machine when they're experimenting with their four-rotor attachment, and they can't get it to work. And they get told by Bletchley that they've broken it, and they reply that, you know, it was broken when it arrived, and it all gets a bit kind of playground. But what I think is interesting about that is it does shine a light on human nature. People think that Bletchley was a very kind of orderly, calm process where, you know, great geniuses sat around thinking great thoughts. Actually, the pressure everybody must have been under and the constraints and just being exhausted through work, you can imagine that all sorts of little flare-ups must have occurred along the way just because of how hard everybody was working and, you know, the stress they were under.
I can imagine that Tommy Flowers himself was not always perhaps the easiest person to work with because he was so focused, so single-minded, very confident in what he was doing. He was obviously a great manager. His team were very loyal to him. And there's an interesting piece in the autobiography of Dame Stephanie Shirley, who started her career at Dollis Hill and worked on the first Prima Bonds computer project, Ernie 1, which again was built by Tommy Flowers and his team. And although she didn't have a great time at Dollis Hill because she left because of prejudice against her as a woman, she spoke fondly of Tommy Flowers as a good manager, as someone who could inspire people to come up with ideas and give them space to take them forward. But outside of his team, I think he could be difficult at times within the post office management structure, I think. So I can quite imagine that people that he worked with closely might not take his single-mindedness too well.
I think you also have the problem that, particularly in a pressured wartime environment, people are looking for new ideas. But if you come in with an idea that is so revolutionary and completely untried, which valves were at that period, there was a lot of scepticism about. So Flowers was up against a certain amount of entrenched opinion. I mean, you look at the analogy with R.V. Jones when he was describing German rocket research to the Scientific Intelligence Committee. And the Scientific Intelligence Committee were going, oh, well, we looked into all this in the 1930s and we know it doesn't work, so we don't need to worry about it. They hadn't really appreciated that the Germans had overcome all the obstacles that they thought were unclimbable. I think the same thing applies with Flowers and valves, that it's too revolutionary in a way, it's too new, and he has to win that argument.
Yes, I mean, in a kind of academic environment that perhaps was here amongst some of the code breakers, there was no published work or academic sources to refer to because all that Tommy knew, he'd experienced it firsthand, that he was literally at the cutting edge of the technology. So he'd had experience, but no one else had, of working with large numbers of valves. And he knew they were reliable, could be reliable. And as you know, the distinguishing thing was that he realized if you don't switch them off and don't heat them up too much, they're actually very reliable. It's the fact that if you keep switching them on and off, that's when they become unreliable and they do break. So it's understandable that people who didn't have that knowledge from the experience that they did have would think that a device using so many of these valves, each individual unit could break. They'd be spending more time switching out valves than actually doing any work with them. But Tommy knew that they were reliable and proved it ultimately.
The GPO are involved with Bletchley from the very beginning, from 1938. There's this story that Bletchley is chosen because it's on the Oxford-Cambridge train line. I'm more convinced by the story that it's also on the GPO trunk lines to the north of England. And so that electronic connectivity is really important from day one, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, that's interesting, which I hadn't realised before, actually. Your research into that was really interesting about that. Is, as you say, the trunk network passes very close to this site through Fenny Stretford, I think, as
yes,
it sits.
Yes.
And so in that sense, it'd be an obvious advantage to this site as well as its railway connections. And around that time, the GPO was already developing a whole new network for government and the armed forces in the Defence Teleprinter Network, which BT only switched off in the noughties. It was so successful, it ran from getting on for 50 years. It was only switched off with the development of secure virtual networks.
Again, Lake Buzzard, just near here, was one of the hubs for it.
I think with the approach of war, the military establishment needed a secure network to connect all the widespread satellite stations they had dotted around the country, and of course, obviously, including this place as well. And it had to be secure, separate from the other network, and well-maintained, and the GPO was the best place to do that.
It's not only places like Bletchley. I mean, it serves in the Battle of Britain, doesn't it? Because all the observer stations and the control centres for the RAF are linked by this same network.
Indeed.
That kind of big spider web of organisation that directs Spitfires towards German bombers relies on this in the same way, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And of course, a large part of that was built and developed during the war itself. And this is a time when at least a third of the engineering department of GPO had signed up and enlisted in the forces. So, you know, it's a huge achievement of the GPO to develop this new network as well as maintain the existing networks with a reduced complement. So they were having to bring back retired engineers and really for the very first time directly recruit women as engineers.
I was going to ask about that. Is that a recognisable trend in post office employment in that respect?
Yes. They'd experimented with it in the First World War, but hadn't really gone for it in a big way. But the Second World War, they did from about 1941 start recruiting women with the agreement of the unions. It had to be negotiated with the agreements as a temporary arrangement. And by the end of the war, they had approaching 5,000 women in engineering roles. They weren't actually called engineers. And it took me a while to realise we have photographs of women clearly working as engineers in exchanges and in the field, but no actual reference to them in the archives. And then came across a reference to female temporary assistant, FTAs. GPO, like any organisation, is very big on acronyms. So all these references to FTAs and realised these are the female engineers. They were called FDAs rather than engineers because the union required that. The union had a charming term. They used a dilution agreement because it was diluting the male establishment by bringing these women in. And to begin with, it's very strictly defined what the women could do as engineers, but within a very short space of time, and they're doing pretty much the same work as the men.
It's a feature of the women at Bletchley that in teleprinting, for example, WAF, women in the Royal Air Force, are allowed to operate the machines, but they're not allowed to repair the machines. That's considered a man's technical engineering job. On the bomb side, it's the same. There are a few women who manage to get themselves trained to be engineers as well, but there is this sort of prejudice that women can operate, but women can't fix.
Yes. The workforce weren't institutionally sexist as such, but there was a concern amongst the male workers and certainly amongst the unions that the post office would replace them with women who would be paid less, of course. And they're probably right to suspect that because it made commercial sense for the post office to do that. So at the end of the war, sadly, the women had to go back to what they were doing before or find other roles, or at least from 1946, the union finally lost patience and said to the post office, look, this was a temporary arrangement. So by 1947, they'd all gone. And GPO didn't recruit women again as engineers until the 60s.
And the other thing in terms of technology that I was learning about in the teleprinter building itself is that you have the whole VF wing in there. That was very new technology at the time as well. Voice frequency telegraphy is where you send teleprinter signals down a phone line. But because you can use all the different frequencies within the range of the phone line to send something like 16 channels of teleprint down the same line. And if you do it right, you can also keep a reduced bandwidth voice signal on there as well.
The post office had switched over to teleprinters for telegraphy generally in the early 30s. Until then, they were still using a whole variety of Morse or other equipment. And then they more or less sort of swept that all away, introduced teleprinters.
trouble is teleprinters have sort of gone again now. I mean, younger visitors here, you say to them, do you know what a teleprinter is? And they look at you blankly.
So no, quite.
It's a technology that came and went.
It only went relatively recently. I mean, ultimately, it became telex, which to all intents and purposes looked like computer terminals. And again, BT only switched telex network off in about 2005, I think.
All right. And of course, the building where we have the D-Day exhibition is the teleprinter building. And the GPO are very heavily involved in there supporting all of that equipment and keeping those connections going. And I think there was something like 40-odd staff, GPO staff permanently here on site doing that kind of work.
Yeah, as you say, teleprinters are really forgotten about now. But of course, it's not that long ago that you get the football results on grandstand on the teleprinter. You used to watch the results come up on the teleprinter as they're printed off. And BBC One News, the music introduction to it was based on the sound of a teleprinter. So the whole story of Bletchley Park and Tommy Flowers and Colossus is a huge source of pride for people in BT on many levels with regard to Tommy Flowers, because it's a story of innovation, and BT's always been really proud of its heritage of innovation going back to the dawn of the technology in the 1830s. It's also a great story of teamwork, because it wasn't just Tommy, it was the whole team behind him. Sid Broadhurst, Harry Fensom, Alan Coombs and the like, all now sadly passed. Fantastic engineers in their own right. And it's a great story for new joiners and apprentices who are joining BT today, because everybody wants to work for an organisation which does something important, something they can be proud of. And it's a huge source of inspiration for that. This is the tradition they're joining. This is the career they could follow. They could do things like this themselves. So all in all, it's a fantastic story for BT.
Are people still follow that career path in terms of starting as apprentices, what, in their teens? Or can you still do it by that route, or do you have to go to university nowadays?
It's a little bit wider than that, but no, you don't have to go to university. We take apprentices from teenage years, but we also take slightly older ones now who are doing a career change. But no, we still have a very active apprenticeship programme. And not just in engineering, across many career paths now across the company. And it's something that, again, BT is very proud of. In the same way that BT is very proud is that I think we're the largest employer of ex-service people, who many of them typically go into engineering roles in Openreach, but again, others go into other careers to a senior level in BT.
We've discussed Tommy and Colossus during the war. What happens to him and his machines in 1945?
Well, come the end of the war, the order came from Churchill, I believe, that the whole thing had to be kept secret, and anything to do with Colossus had to be destroyed. So the Colossi were largely dismantled and disposed of, with the exception of a couple which I think went to what became GCHQ. And Tommy himself is quoted as saying that, you know, he had a bonfire of some of his papers all to do with Colossus. So in BT's archives, we have nothing on Colossus itself and the work that Tommy did at Bletchley Park, which is a great shame. And Tommy and his team, like the rest of the establishment at Bletchley Park, quietly went back to their pre-war lives. Tommy and his team went back to researching electronic switching. It's clear that they were influenced by the work they did during the war, as indeed they're influenced by the work they did before the war for what they did at Bletchley Park. But they went back largely to telephone switching, developing electronic telephone exchanges. And as an aside, they went on to other projects. So they developed the first premium bonds computer, Ernie, in 1958, I think it was, and then went on to other computer projects like Mosaic for the Ministry of Supply, I think, again, in the 50s. But largely what they did at Dollis Hill for the war and at Bletchley Park, they didn't talk about, as so many other veterans didn't talk about. It was only really towards the end of his life that Tommy's huge achievement and his contribution started to be recognised. And even today, it's only now becoming really widely known.
It must have been a difficult thing, because you see the same with Max Newman, who was involved with Colossus as well. He and Turing go off to Manchester and they are working in computing, but they're not mentioning, you know, 6 years of work. It must have been the same at Dollis Hill, that you had these people with a tremendous amount of expertise that they could no doubt discuss amongst themselves, but they weren't able to express publicly where they were getting their ideas from.
That's right. You see that in the newsletter. There was a newsletter, and still is, of research establishment, research labs, veterans, pensioners. They still keep in touch. And the early ones from the early days of BT, of course, there were still active people in that who had worked with Tommy Flowers during the war and immediately after the war. And so they were recording some of their memories in there of working with Tommy and what they're doing and how they couldn't talk about it outside what was then the GPO and later BT. Very recently, a very senior BT research director called Roy Harris passed away, sadly. He was well over 90. He was a good age. And we were fortunate enough to record an oral history interview with Roy about 20 years ago. And he talked about his whole career. His whole career was in the post office and latterly BT. He first joined in 1947 and worked at Dollis Hill, and he worked for Tommy Flowers. So is that direct link between a very senior BT engineer who went on in his later career at BT to be largely responsible and roll out the first digital network in the UK, the System X, which is only now being replaced by next generation networks. So there is that very real, very tangible link between Bletchley Park and BT in that sense.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I feel that there's some little difficulty because the opening remarks have anticipated some of the things that I said naturally. And also this lecture, which I'm giving today, is a sort of dry run for the lecture which I shall give in 2 weeks' time in America. So it might sound a bit strange in some places. I mean, I use tubes instead of valves, for example. But I propose to stick to, more or less, to the text which I shall give in America, because it's too difficult for me to change it at a short notice. As Brian has said, during World War II, I conceived and built a new sort of machine, of which nothing was said for 30 years, and it was Brian Randall's efforts, he was the first man to chance upon the fact that it had been produced and to do a lot of research and eventually to get some sort of publication out of the British security people. He then realised that this was an electronic processor, and this caused him to raise the question whether it was some sort of computer. That a Colossus occurred at all was due to a series of very lucky chances, to which one more is added because of it I'm to be numbered amongst the computer pioneers, which is the purpose of this lecture which I'm giving in America. Because at the time I had no thought of computers. In fact, I had never heard of the term other than applied to somebody who did calculations by means of a desk machine. I propose to give an account of the circumstances and the events that led up to the conception and the production of this machine, as I feel that you will feel that that's just as interesting and important as the description of the machine itself. I have to start with two items of research which occurred before the war at the old Dollis Hill laboratories of the post office. When I went there in 1930 to research into automatic telephone exchanges, the limit of distance over which calls could be dialed by the public from the ordinary telephones was about 40 miles. And to extend that limit, in 1934, the post office designed a system which introduced thermionic vacuum tubes, radio tubes, into telephone exchanges for the first time and in large numbers. And by the time the war started in 1939, we had one or two exchanges which had several thousand tubes in continuous and satisfactory operation, and this was going to provide some useful evidence later. A second and much more difficult problem was the large proportion of calls which were dialed by the public, which finished up as wrong numbers or no connections at all. One of the jobs that I was given was to find out the reasons why so many of the calls fail. And the more I learnt about the system, the more I became convinced that there must be some better way of making the telephone exchange than the way in which we were doing it. And by 1935, I'd become interested in electronics as a possible alternative. I was led in that direction by reading the literature, also by working in telephone exchanges and repeater stations, and also by knowing what other people had done. For example, Wynne Williams in Cambridge had produced a high-speed counter, which used Cyrotron tubes, which are gas-filled semi-empty tubes, as you probably know. I believe that very few people know anything about tubes these days, so I have to be a little bit gal. Perhaps explain more than I should otherwise do. Also, the Eccles-Jordan trickle circuit, which could be used as a relay, and which, of course, is the basis of a good many memory systems in modern electronics, had actually been invented in 1919. Also, I knew that electronic devices had already been used in transmission systems, not only for amplification, which, of course, transmission systems are wholly dependent, but also as switches in modulators. The transmission people used electronics as switches more before the switching people did. They used them as modulators because of the high-speed characteristics of the switch. And the telegraph people used copper oxide rectifiers, which became available in the 1920s, as relays, not for their speed characteristics, but just for their reliability. And also that they didn't need any adjustment. Once they were installed, they worked forever. Knowing the usage which electronics had already been applied, it occurred to me that we might be able to use them in the switching field. I started to consider what parts of a telephone exchange might be replaced by electronic devices. And in fact, I designed some such parts. But by 1939, I felt able to prove, both by practice and theory, that an electronic equivalent could be produced of any electromechanical switching or data processing system which existed or might exist. And I well remember the elation that I felt when I first reached that point, because I realized that not only could parts of automatic exchanges be made electronic, but complete exchanges might one day be electronic. I had only the haziest ideas at that time of how it might come about or how it might be done, but I was quite convinced that that was a possibility. I met some other people in the field who were proposing to use electronic devices as adjuncts to particular sorts of telephone equipments, but none, as I'm now sure, had the concept that large parts of an exchange or even a whole exchange could be made by electronic means. And if there was any work going on in other parts of the world on the same subject, I didn't know about it because it hadn't been published. And in fact, I hadn't reached the stage where I might be publish anything myself. So that was the state of the art when the war started in 1939 and all civil work had to be subordinated to war work. And no longer could we do what we liked, but we had to do what we were told. And what I was told to do in 1941 was to go to Bletchley Park and to receive some top secret work. By good luck, I was about to be involved in code breaking, and this would provide an opportunity for the immediate application of the work which I had done pre-war, something which might not have happened, in fact didn't happen, for a whole generation after the war. Cryptanalysts at Bletchley Park had succeeded from the early days of the war in reading German secret messages which had been encoded on a machine called an Enigma. Alan Turing, a name well known in computer circles, was taking a leading part in this work, and it was he who explained it to me when I got to Bletchley Park and what the post office was required to do. And what the post office was required to do was nothing to do with the code breaking, but using telephone switches and techniques, make some machines which were equivalent to the Enigma coding machines, but could work much faster. Two other Dollis Hill engineers were to be allowed to share the secrets of Bletchley Park. They were Sidney Broadhurst, who regrettably died a few months ago, and Bill Chandler, who is here this afternoon. But otherwise, the purpose of the machines was to be kept secret from everybody else. In the 3 months that it took us to make the first machine and get it into operation, it was realised that the machines weren't really wanted. They were not required. And had that been realised earlier, and there was some suspicion that it might have been, that their planning probably was a bit faulty, then Dollis Hill might never have been involved with Bletchley Park, and the course of the war could have been different, although not its final result. But we were there and available when the next big problem turned up, which required engineering assistance. The Germans had invented a new machine for sending teleprinter messages in cipher. The machine looked like a teleprinter and was operated like a teleprinter, but it had the great difference that messages which were typed out on the keyboard in plain language were transmitted in cipher, and messages which were received in cipher into the machine were printed in plain language, all automatically and with no more effort on the part of the operator than having to set the machine mechanically to some initial settings which were specified in a code book. The principle of this machine had been invented in 1917 by an American. I've got to put this in my lecture, as you understand. called Gilbert Vernon. But it had not been used very much up to then because of operational difficulties. The enciphered messages were received into Bletchley Park on 5-hole punch tape. The length of the tape as received might be up to 100 feet long. The teleprinter characters are 5 binary digit numbers, and these are represented with punched holes across the paper. So each line of the punched holes is one teleprinter character. Between the second and the third digits, there is a small hole, which is the sprocket hole, and that is punched and then used afterwards to drive the paper by means of a sprocket wheel for reading. For the purposes of Bletchley Park, they added 2 other holes, a start hole between the third and the fourth characters, which indicated to the processor when the message was about to start, and then it could start processing, and the stop hole between the fourth and fifth character to indicate when the message is stopped, that would stop the processing. The start and the stop holes were put in by a punch, which we can actually see later on. The main interest in the punch now being that it's one of very few relics of Colossus. There's a set of tubes which were used. There's a broken mask, a few photographs. But that's all the tangible evidence that Colossus ever existed. And we owe the preservation of this punch to the foresight of Harry Fenton, who is also in the audience, who took it into protective custody when he left. The principle by which the messages were enciphered was by means of code wheels. The code wheels had round their periphery a number of 2-position cams which could be pushed by hand from one side of the disc to the other, and they were latched in whichever position they were pushed, and this was done by the operator periodically as specified in the code book. And what it produced was a pattern in binary code round the periphery of the wheel, which could be varied as required. And they were all of different sizes, and they were all primed to one another, the number of cams, so there was no common factor. Each element of the teleprinter code was enciphered separately, so that for the complete machine, there were 2 sets of 5 wheels. One set of wheels, the whole set moved 1 step for every character which was enciphered, or deciphered, both reversible. So as each character was sent or received, so the wheels stepped round one at a time. The other set of 5 wheels didn't move with every character, but intermittently under the control of 2 other wheels, so there were 12 wheels in all, 2 other wheels which had cams on them, which the combination of which decided whether the second lot would move or not. Because all the operating positions were primed to one another, the number of combinations of wheel positions before the sequence repeated, that meant the number of characters which could be sent before the cipher repeated, was astronomical. Effectively, it never repeated. And this gave such confidence to the enemy that used these machines for sending messages of the highest importance, such as battle orders in great detail, and even messages from Hitler giving instructions and information to his field commanders. Maxwell Newman, who lectured in mathematics in Cambridge and at one time had Alan Turing as one of his students, was brought in to Bletchley Park to study this traffic. The problem presented to him was to find first the wheel patterns, because the wheel patterns were changed periodically, and then for each message, the starting positions of the 12 wheels which enciphered the message. Newman had the idea that a key tape, which had been formed into a loop, which in some way reflected the construction of the coding machine, if it was formed into a tape and it was processed against a message tape, also formed into a loop, so that the two would be driven around in continuously. And if the processing was continued until every relative position of the key tape relative to the message tape had been gone through, then some clue might be obtained. And with that clue and another key tape, another clue might be obtained. And if this was continued long enough, then a solution might emerge. The simple way of making the two tapes go around in all possible relative positions was to make the numbers of characters in the two tapes prime to one another. That's to say, if there's no common factor, then in time they will all go around and they'll all get the same. The quantity of processing which was needed to carry out these operations was manifestly so great that some sort of a machine was necessary. And even a machine with the fastest data processing techniques available at the time would have taken much too long to produce results which are operationally useful. It's no use finding out a month after you get a message what's inside the message. Obviously, some much faster processing had to be used, and electronics was realised to be essential. And as counting was part of the processing, when Williams, who had invented the counter, as I mentioned, was brought in to design the machine, and then F.O. Morrell, who was the head of Telegraph Group at Dollis Hill, was brought in and given charge of the project, actually, to make it. Because the tapes were too long to hang freely, as I said, the message tape might be 100 feet long. In fact, 200 feet tapes were very occasionally met. Some means of supporting them had to be devised, what became known as a bedstead, and the system of pulleys was movable to accommodate different lengths of tape. The speed at which the tape was going to be driven and had to be read meant that only photoelectric reading was possible, and two Dollis Hill physicists, Eric Spate and Arnold Lynch, designed a photographic reader in a very short time, and the Dollis Hill workshop made it. It resembled a cinematograph projector, except that it projected the other way around. Let's say it projected from the lamp to an optical system on the gate into the machine and produced an image of the tape on a mask which was made on a photographic plate and which was inside the machine. Behind the masks, there were photo cells and amplifiers, and the output from the amplifiers gave us the reading off the tape. This was tested as soon as possible, as soon as the necessary bedsteads and means of running the tape was produced. To give some idea of the problem, of the conditions, a message tape might be typically 5,000 characters long, and a key tape 1,000 characters. And to do one complete test, the longer tape would have to do 1,000 revolutions, and the shorter tape would have to do 5,000 revolutions driven by mechanical sprockets. It seemed to me that the chance that paper tape or any sort of tape would stand up to this sort of treatment was not worth the bother of trying. And I was glad I wasn't in charge of the project and expected to produce the impossible. The first tests were not particularly encouraging. The first problem was the adhesive which stuck the ends of the tape together. If it was strong enough, it was too brittle and quickly broke up. If it was flexible enough, it came apart. And it needed a minor research by somebody at the Dollis Hill to solve that problem. It was not the paper tape that was essential to the processing, but the data which it contained. All that the key tape was doing was storing pre-generated data so that they could be read at much higher speed into the processor. An electronic equivalent of the machine that originally generated the data, and I was quite sure that an electronic equivalent existed or could be made, or even though I didn't at that time know how to make it, it could be made to work fast enough to generate the data continuously and thus eliminate the key tape. Only one loop of tape would then be needed, you know, the message tape, and that could be driven by smooth-faced pulleys at any particular speed was found suitable. Thus, the trouble and the labour of producing key tapes, which was quite considerable, and also the difficulty of aligning the two tapes in the machine as they had to, was eliminated. This suggestion, which I made in February 1943, was received with considerable scepticism. The first objection or first reaction was that a machine that had so many tubes in it, as this one would obviously have, would never be satisfactory in practice because of the notoriously high rate of failure of tubes. But we were able to quote the experience which I mentioned earlier on of tubes which we had in telephone exchanges, which were giving satisfactory service in large numbers because they were not moved, they were stationary, and the reputation for bad service which the tubes had got up to that time was mostly based on transportable radio and other equipment. And also they were not switched on and off. They were on continuously and the heaters never went off and never came on. The second objection that was put up was that because there was no precedent for such a machine, it would take too long to get it designed and manufactured and the war would be over before it could be effective, which happened with the ENIAC in America, which I won't say in America. We replied that Dollis Hill had the skill and the resources to produce such a machine in, we thought, about a year. And in February 1943, it was very optimistic to think that the war would be over by February 1944. The third objection was we couldn't really defeat because being such a new concept, we couldn't guarantee. I mean, they said, well, can you guarantee that something new will work and be satisfactory? And of course, we had to say we couldn't. So it was decreed that the two tape machines work should go on and have first priority. And what to do about the all-electronic machine should be left to be decided by the people who would have to make it, which was fair enough. And that decision proved to be very wise because from about the middle of 1943, two tape machines were actually in operation and operating at a rate of 2,000 characters per second. The solution which had been found was to motor one of the smooth face pullers so that the sprockets had very little work to do but just keep in synchronism. Much valuable work was done by these machines, which were called Robinson machines, after Heath Robinson. Well, I don't need to explain to you, but I'll explain to an American audience who Heath Robinson was. Much valuable work in validating and developing Newman's ideas, and also the ideas of others who Newman recruited, other mathematicians who came in onto the job. The quantity of messages which it decoded was very small fraction of the total, but nevertheless it was valuable. Meanwhile, the Dollis Hill engineers took only 11 months, as Brian has said, to design, make and put into service the first Colossus machine. This feat was very largely due to the ultra top priority which we were given to command labour and services without any questions being asked, and to the prodigious efforts of the Dollis Hill engineers, many of whom who did nothing for weeks and months but work, eat and sleep, except for a half day a week which they allowed themselves for the necessities of life, such as talking to their wives and getting their hair cut. The United States contributed to the first Colossus by providing most of the tubes and the electromagnetic typewriter under the lease lend arrangements. The responsibility for the overall design and the detailed design was shared between Sidney Broadhurst, Bill Chandler and myself, with Alan Coombs coming in later when the machine was redesigned with improvements which were found by experience. The first machine was operational in the early part of December 1943, and it was the Bletchley Park people who christened it Colossus because it was the largest machine that they had had to operate up to that time. The cryptanalysts were impressed, first of all, by the speed at which it worked, which is 5,000 characters a second, which was against 2,000 on the Robinsons, and also by its reliability. They soon came to realise that unexpected results were genuine and not due to some fault on the machine, in contrast to the Robinsons, which for some reasons which were never fully explained, were subject to occasional errors which could waste hours of a cryptanalyst's time. As you can imagine, the cryptanalysts soon got used to the machine and then started to invent new processes, and some of which couldn't have been done on a Robinson machine. The practical speed at which it was possible to run the tape was tested to find out how near to the limit we were. A maximum length tape was mounted in the machine, and then it was all speeded up until something happened. And at 9,700 characters per second, the tape broke in one and then several places. And the several parts then did their best to obey Newton's first law of motion and continue travelling in a straight line with an initial velocity of nearly 60 miles an hour. And so finished up in all sorts of unexpected places. Obviously, then, we were not going to run the tape at much more than 5,000 characters a second, and even that wasn't fast enough to reduce the number of machines which we envisaged as being ultimately required to manageable proportions. We needed to go much faster than that. So we then had the idea of parallel processing, that by having five processors all operating to the same program but using different inputs from the tape, effectively the processing speed was multiplied by five so that it became 25,000 characters per second, and that was enough. I might say at this point that when I use the terms program and programmer and things with which you're familiar, I don't want to imply that we used them in those days. We didn't. We talked about sequences rather than programs, even circuits. And, well, we didn't have any programmers, I suppose, just design. We didn't use store. We used the term memory for events which were remembered, for example, by relays. And we had temporary memories and permanent memories. We didn't call them semi-permanent. We called them permanent. And I don't know why they're now called semi-permanent. But I'm using the term for the computer audience I should be talking to, because it'll make it much easier for them to understand, I hope. Well, the parallel processing meant the photoelectric reader had to read not two lines of the tape, but six lines of the tape, because each of the processors needed two lines, and the first processor would take the first two lines, and then the next one, the second and third, and so forth, so it needed to read six lines. And to design a tape reader to read six lines of tape, I think nothing we ever asked Arnold Lynch the question. It was quite out of the question. So to solve that problem, we invented the shift register. I think we were the first, but maybe we weren't. And this meant that we had to read only one line of the tape. We remembered all the rest in shift registers. And in fact, the parallel processing resulted in the tape reader being simplified instead, compared with the Robinsons, rather than being made more complicated. Anticipating that the first Colossus would be a success and that more would be needed in a hurry, we started to redesign the machine even before the first one was operating. That was when Doc Coombs came in. We redesigned some of the mechanical parts to be more efficient, more easily used, and also to incorporate the improvements which we had seen by doing the first one. A principal element of the Colossus was the bitstream generator, which replaced the Robinson key tapes. This comprised a bank of 12 rings of thyrotron tubes, which were operating as Wynn Williams-type counters, and which generated the bit streams from semi-permanent data stored in the machine. The rings and the processing, of course, had to be electronic, because they were required to work at high speed. But electromagnetic telephone exchange equipment was also used in large quantities for slower speed operations, because that was the best way in which the machine could be realized. The first Colossus had contained 1,500 tubes. The production Colossus machines had 2,400 tubes because of the increased processing power in the facilities. It had 12 large rotary switches, about 800 relays, and an IBM Electromatic. Electromatic, that's the trade name for it. It was an electrically operated typewriter. Not only did we start the redesign, but we also started making the parts, which is just as well, because in February or March, I'm not quite sure the date, 1944, we received instructions that 12 new machines were to be in operation at Bletchley Park by June the 1st, which was only 3 or 4 months away. This requirement had stemmed not only from the success of the first Colossus, but also from the increasingly widespread use of this type of machine by the enemy, and from improved German operating procedures, which meant we had to work much harder to achieve the same results. The instructions had come from the highest level, and I well remember the consternation when I had to say flatly that it was impossible. All that I could promise, or all that I did promise, was that using the parts we'd already made and the start we'd already made on the redesign, we would have one machine operating in Bletchley Park by the June the 1st date. That would be made in the laboratories. For the rest, we would have to organise the Birmingham factory to produce components for us, which we would assemble at Dollis Hill. And we thought that we could achieve an output of one Colossus per month from the time that the first one was in operation. On May the 31st, the first machine was in fact installed at Bletchley Park and was working satisfactorily, except for occasional random faults, which we just couldn't find the reason for. And by midnight on that night, the commissioning team were so tired that they decided to go home for a few hours' sleep. When they came back the following morning, which was June the 1st, at 8:30, the machine was actually in operation, because one of our Dollis Hill people, who was permanently stationed in Bletchley Park and was on night work that night, on the night shift, he discovered the fault to be parasitic oscillation of some of the valves and had cured it by the insertion of a few resistors. So the machine was actually in commission at 8:30 on the day in which we'd promised it. That particular man, incidentally, was Norman Thurlow. I wish I could convey to you the dedication, the excitement and the satisfaction of those days, but one had to experience it in order to know what it was like. When the German surrender came 11 months later and put an abrupt end, of course, to the whole enterprise, there were, in fact, 10 machines in operation, and the 11th one was about to be commissioned. To what extent it might be regarded as a computer in the modern sense is something which I'm not too anxious to get involved in. It certainly had features now associated with computers, semi-permanent and temporary data storage, arithmetic and logic units, including branching logic and variable programming. The control of Colossus by wired logic and of a computer by stored program logic, which gives the stored program computer its general purpose characteristics, is the most obvious difference. Colossus was a special purpose machine required to attain the highest possible processing speed. A computer designed to the same requirements might well have to use wired instead of stored program logic, but it would still be a computer. Colossus was a computer in conception and in processing power comparable with the ENIAC, which was designed as a computer but without stored program logic, and came into operation 2 years after Colossus. Colossus undoubtedly made a contribution to the development of computers in Britain by showing Turing, Newman and some others what electronics could do, and that knowledge turned their minds to computers immediately after the war. The events which I have been recounted happened so long ago that when I came to think about what I might say, I found that I'd forgotten many of the details, and this had the happy result that the inquiries which I had to make caused me to contact many of the people who took part at the time, and some of whom I had not seen since. That was in itself a pleasure, and the information which they gave me a great help, which I gratefully acknowledge. I'm also indebted to these laboratories for the slides. Two quotations provide me with appropriate words with which to end this lecture. The first is attributed to United States Air Force General Doolittle when he visited Bletchley Park and gave a pep talk to the staff, in which he said, "Fighting a war when you can read your enemy's messages is like playing poker when you can see your opponent's cards. In the end, you are bound to win." And the second quotation comes from Max Newman, who, when the war in Europe was over, had to call everybody together and announce that the unit was to be disbanded and they could all go home. And after thanking them for their efforts, he concluded that to lose the most interesting and exciting job we're ever likely to have in our whole lives is the price that we have to pay for peace.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.